I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where I speak with creative entrepreneurs, artists, and other insanely interesting people to hear their stories, learn about their molding moments, tipping points, and spectacular takeoffs. In this special two-part episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Lisa DeLong about her work as a pediatric nurse, overcoming the loss of a child, and how we navigate grief and painful experiences in our own lives. Lisa, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, I came across you by way of our mutual friend, Joe Loya, who had mentioned your name in the interview that I did with him. And I was really intrigued by what it is that you do. So can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, the journey before the journey that has led you to what you're up to in the world today?
Sure. I am a registered nurse originally, and I'm a mom, and I've been married for 31 years. I have four kids. Two of my sons have had leukemia. So my journey as a mother, wife, parent, caregiver, all of those elements have kind of come into play in my life now and over the last about 20 years. My older son, Justin, was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 5 years old, and this was back in 1990. And he went into remission, and he was in remission for almost 10 years. At that time, my husband Dave and I had had three more children, and Justin was in the middle of his eighth grade year. He was an athlete, loved to run. My husband's a cross country and track coach, and so running and activities were a big part of our family, mountain biking and all that kind of stuff. So in that 10-year period, life became very normal. And in the middle of his eighth grade year, his leukemia came back very suddenly, and he died 5 months later. At that time, Jessica, our oldest, was almost 11. Joelle, our second daughter, was 6 years old. And our youngest, our baby, was only 9 months old, Jacob. So 6 years after Justin's passing, Jacob was 6 years old, and he had a low-grade fever and a cough and a cold that was kind of lingering. And we found out that he too had leukemia, the same kind that Justin had, even though it was a non-familial kind of leukemia. So my whole life in the last about almost 30 years now has been about trying to keep my kids alive, really. Jacob is now 14 years old and healthy and starting high school actually tomorrow. So it's definitely a milestone day for us tomorrow. It's an emotional time, really, to have a son who's entering an arena that my older son never was able to enter. And my husband is, like I said, a teacher and a track and cross country coach at the high school where my son is going to be attending. And so it's definitely a tender time. I filled out all the paperwork just a couple weeks ago to get him, you know, registered. And we've had both of our girls have gone to the same high school, and they've graduated and gone on to college. And my older daughter is a makeup artist and a nanny, and she lives in Oregon. And then my younger one is in college at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. And she is studying end-of-life care and end-of-life issues, which is interesting. She's turning 21 next week. So, you know, when I reflect back on my life and how we got to this point of having healthy-minded children, I think that's what I can offer to the world as a parent and a woman and as a mother, is how do you get from all that difficult, challenging content to having any sanity at the end of it all. And that's that's kind of what I've been doing a lot of reflecting about lately is I wrote a book called Blood Brothers, and it came out in 2011. It's a memoir of faith and loss related to the experience that I had. And I decided to write that book when I did because Jacob was just finishing some really hard times of chemotherapy and coming out of a, you know, just a really high intensity need period of my life where, you know, my every waking moment was about keeping him as healthy as he could be. And kids on chemotherapy have to be isolated. They, you know, it's most people have some experience with the chemotherapy side effects nowadays because cancer is so prevalent and cancer treatments are so much more open than they used to be. It used to be a very taboo subject to even talk about cancer. So when I look back on just kind of where we are as a society and the norms of illness and life and death and all of those kinds of things, I think we're making huge progress. But I had learned so much about that issue and dealing with the death of a child and the potential of having to do it again and really living with that possibility every day. That's why I decided to write Blood Brothers. And because I'm a nurse, I also have the perspective of being the professional caregiver, and I understood the needs of the medical professionals that were helping me and helping Jacob and attending to our family and all those who did their best to keep Justin alive and keep him in remission for the 10 years that he was. So with that life experience, I felt like it was time to share what I knew with others. And so once my book came out, I started being invited to speak at things like lots of fundraisers, things cancer awareness, and eventually to nurse organizations, nurses who were doing end of life care for adults and children. And so, I began to share my story publicly, through speaking opportunities. And I discovered that I really enjoy public speaking. It's something that I, kind of dabbled in back in junior high, when I met, our friend Joe Loya, who you interviewed and a few weeks ago or months ago. And Joe and I, it's interesting because he and I crossed paths or originally met when we were in junior high at Luther Burbank in Burbank. And we were just a handful of Hispanic kids that lived in Burbank, and we used to walk home from school together. And he had just the most jovial personality, happy-go-lucky. We both won the Student Actor of the Year award that year in our ninth. I think it was our ninth grade year, and no, eighth grade because that was 2 years at junior high. Sorry, that was a long time ago. but anyway, when my book came out, I started a Facebook account and started, you know, exploring social networking at the advice of other authors that I knew. And, one of the first people to friend me was Joe. And I had lost contact with him in the middle of our junior year in high school. And I didn't know what happened to him. And there was no internet in those days and there was no, cell phones. There were no cell phones. So it was difficult to, when someone just left your world back then, they just disappeared. So when he friended me on Facebook, I was so thrilled. I thought, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I'm, you know, my childhood friend, because I really liked Joe back then. He gave me my first album, Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. And I had no clue that he had a crush on me. I thought we were just friends. And I had no clue about anything romantic in those. I was not one of the girls that was like, oh, I want a boyfriend. I was like, what? There's boyfriends? Like, that's kind of more how I operated. And anyway, so when Joe friended me, I was so happy, and we exchanged phone numbers, and we start talking. We called him, just to hear his voice brought me right back to that time in my life when I was very innocent and unaware of death and grief and life illnesses and all of those, the depth of tragedies that I'd experienced by the time we reconnected, that it just felt so good to hear his voice. And so he said, what have you been doing? And he had read a little bit about my book and that I was becoming, that I was a writer. And so I told him all about what had happened with my sons and my family. And then I finished my time of talking and I said, what about you? What have you been up to for the last 30 years? And he said, you haven't heard? And I said, no. And he said, well, I was a really bad guy. And then I became a bank robber. And I almost dropped the phone. I was just like, there's no way the Joe Loya I knew, this skinny, bright, really intelligent, great conversationalist, even in junior high, there's just no way that he had that in him. You know, I was just stunned. So he told me his whole story, and I knew bits and pieces. It kind of helped me make sense of some of the things that I experienced with him in junior high, like going out. I remember going out with him and his dad and his brother to something in LA, and I knew that he didn't have a mom, but I didn't know why, and I didn't know that she had died when he was young, and at least I have no recollection of that now, and I think I was just, that kid, self-absorbed kid back then. I just didn't think to even pay attention to those things. So our friendship really came at a good time because I was learning how to write. Joe helped me with the final edits of my book, and he's been a wonderful mentor to me as I've delved into becoming what it is to be a writer and a and share my story publicly and all the complexities that go with that. So, but it's really, what's really interesting to me is how our lives have intersected around grief. And while his began as a child at the death of his mother, and mine as a mother with the death of a son. And, I think that I definitely believe that that's not an accident that our lives have intersected again. Mm-hmm. And I really look for that in life, those synchronistic, I call them dots, because I really see my life as a big dot to dot puzzle that is just, the dots are all there, and I won't know what my life actually looks like until all the dots are connected. And I don't think all the dots are ever visibly connected until we die. And that's just kind of an image that floats around in my head about like how to make sense of life. Because I come from a Christian background, and I was born into a Catholic home, and my parents took us to Sunday Mass. I have four siblings, so there's five of us, and we attended St. Finbar in Burbank, and I grew up feeling very secure. My parents were good to each other. I was the second youngest. I am the second youngest in my family, so I had older siblings who led the way, and I had a younger sibling that I felt always felt I wanted, kind of needed to take care of. Not in a, just in a sibling sort of way. Everybody's healthy in my family, but I felt very secure as a child. I never worried about my mom and dad not being there. I never worried about them divorcing or anything like that. It was pretty unheard of within my childhood experience. I had friends who'd had parents who divorced and things like that, but it was just never even a thought in my family. So I grew up with a very solid belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But I struggled with some things about our Catholic belief system. And part of that kind of stemmed from my dad, because he would voice very often that he was pretty frustrated with things that he was witnessing going on in the church. And he was, on a personal level, he was just frustrated sometimes with, like my grandma would say, get together, we're going to pray the rosary. And he would roll his eyes and be like, oh, mom, you know, I don't want to pray the rosary. And I think he was forced into many of the Catholic rituals and things in his childhood that he didn't really embrace. So it was and I picked up on that. Like, there, we weren't like the all in totally devout Catholics. We did everything we were supposed to do, but there was some resentment there. And then my mom was very timid. I remember her having to take medication. I didn't know what she took at the time, but she sometimes would say, oh, I have to take my pill before we go to church, because she had so much anxiety about being in groups. And at the same time, I remember all four of us, my four siblings and I, so all five of us and my parents being at church, and just how good it felt to look down that pew and see my brothers kind of poking at each other and my dad kneeling on the, kneeling in prayer with his hands folded on the pew in front of him. And my mom, you know, just sitting nice and quiet, and my sisters and I trying to be good. And and then we would, we'd see my dad's head bob, and we'd realize that he was asleep. And then my brothers would kind of be, you know, we'd all be looking like making fun of dad because he was sleeping. that kind of thing, you know, it just evokes really positive memories for me. And then my dad would, you know, the boys would start laughing, and my dad would, you know, very sometimes he would just wake up cussing at them in church, like, you know, really funny things. And then we'd get in the car and go to A&W root beer, which was at the time there were A&W root beers, you know, the drive-thrus, and we'd pull up and get a root beer float. And that was a big treat, because in those days we did not eat out very often. And so it was, Sundays were a treat, you know, and it was kind of a beautiful reward for to have something sweet after being on our knees all morning, you know. So I look at those roots in my life as a positive thing. And when I was 16, I was introduced to an organization called Young Life, which was a Christian outreach youth group, basically, that helped introduce people to Christ. And I was very attracted to that. And my older sister was also, and she had hosted groups in our home. And so I was a gymnast at the time. I was very athletic, and I would come home from the gym exhausted, and there would be all these teenagers in my living room, you know, laughing and joking and playing skits, and they were being silly and they were singing, and I was just irritated with all of them because I just wanted to go to bed. But I got the message that they were talking about Jesus, and I wanted to know more. So when I got into high school, I explored the same thing, and was really led by some very wonderful and compassionate and fun people of faith who introduced me to how to study the Bible rather than be in catechism. And I was very interested in knowing Christ more. And so I committed my life to Christ and began attending evangelical churches, and I explored so many, Foursquare as well as Knot. And anyway, I met my high school sweetheart there. That's where Dave and I got married, and he was also very involved in Young Life. And we had a very, very idyllic kind of high school relationship. He was the jock. I was the cheerleader. We were very grounded in faith in Christ, and went through our whole high school and college experience together in a very wholesome way. And then we married and had Justin and bought our first home. And I mean, it couldn't have been a more textbook kind of picture perfect beginning. And so when Justin was diagnosed, Dave and I were 29 years old when that reality that even no matter how good you are as a person, how much faith you have, bad things can still happen. And I've heard, you know, I think that's the most difficult thing for us as human beings, to make sense of why bad things happen and why bad things happen to good people. And Justin was one of those kids who any family would consider the golden child of the family. He was very easy from the time he was a baby. I remember my sister, Lori, my older sister, had a baby before me. And he was very colicky, and he would cry and cry. And she was just, sometimes she was just losing her mind trying to raise this kid. And then I had Justin, who, you know, would sit quietly smiling and at a restaurant or a movie or at the house. And he was just, they don't come any easier than this kid. and he was like that his whole life. And even when he was very ill and newly diagnosed, I remember he was, when he was 5 years old, I had made his appointment for his pediatrician, for his, you know, get his vaccines and his kindergarten checkup. So I brought him in, and he had been a little bit pale for about 2 weeks. And I thought, well, you know, I'll get him checked out when he has his appointment, because he didn't act ill at all. No fever. Well, he had a low grade fever at one point, but it was so mild and it kind of came and went. And anyway, we walked into the doctor's office and we were sitting there, and I remember looking at the chart on the wall that said, you know, make sure your child eats correctly from the food pyramid, and make sure they have their vaccines. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, gosh, I'm such a good mom. You know, I have him here, and it's all on time, and he's up to date on his vaccines, and, you know, everything. And the pediatrician walked in, who was a doctor I worked with at the hospital, because I was a mother baby nurse at the time. And, he took one look at Justin, and he turned to me and he said, "You nurses, you know how to take care of everyone's kids but your own." And I automatically started crying, and I thought, I can't see what he sees. I don't know what provoked that comment. And then he examined Justin, and I went into his office, and he was very apologetic and kind from that point on. I think it was just a initial like snap when he saw him. He said that, you know, Justin needed to go get his blood work checked, to take him to get his blood drawn, that he thought he might have leukemia. And so that day I took Justin and had his blood drawn for the first time, and he was just so compliant. I could, you know, tell him to sit still and let the lady, you know, this is what's going to happen. Let the lady, the needle's going to take some blood out. It's going to hurt a little bit. And he was just, okay, mommy, you know, very, very compliant kid. And then, the doctor also wanted Justin to have a bone marrow aspiration, which is a very common procedure anytime a person needs to have their blood tested to a greater degree to find out what's actually causing the abnormalities. And so I had to take Justin to the to an adult oncologist who happened to be open that day at lunchtime. And again, this was a long time ago. This was 1990, so things are not done this way anymore for the most part. But a lot of times back then, it was difficult to get a diagnosis. And I know plenty of families who have had children with leukemia who have lingered for months without a diagnosis. So to get a diagnosis, it takes a certain amount of complex lab procedures. So, which are much easier to do now than they were before. Mm-hmm. But that day, I took him to the adult oncologist's office. Everyone was at lunch except for the physician. And he told me that I would have to hold him and hold Justin in a fetal position, which I was experienced with as a nurse. And I think because I'm a nurse, the pediatrician I worked with and the other people automatically make assumptions that, oh, you're a nurse, you can do this. You know how, you have a certain skill set that comes with RN behind your name. But what they don't realize is that this is your child. and yes, I was glad that I had the skill set that I had, but, and I still am, but there's a balancing act to that as caregivers and professionals, and from the professional perspective to the parent. And I do speak on this issue quite a bit to nurse groups and physicians and that kind of thing, hospice care, because it gets to be a blurred line sometimes for parents with a medical background. So that day I held him, and thankfully one of the things I'd learned from nursing school was to never to lie to a child. You don't want to tell them that, look at the flower and look away. This isn't going to hurt. And then it hurts. You know what I mean? Like distracting them and telling them that something's not going to hurt. And then it hurts. They're not going to trust you ever again. So, I told Justin that this was going to hurt. But if he laid very still, it would go much quicker. He did. He was, like I said, very compliant. He curled up into a little ball and I held him. And I just remember, him crying because of course a bone marrow aspiration requires, using a fairly large gauge needle and penetrating the bone at the hip, the back of the hip. And so we just were both crying through this procedure. And I remember this image of, you know, how exam tables have white paper draped over them. And I just remember his tears and my tears melding on that white paper and becoming one big blot of moisture. And how and that image sticks with me, you know, as challenging as the day was, that, you know, we were in it together. And any parent who has had a sick child, and also just someone you love, I think especially children, you would just shed your skin for them and take their place if you could. And those early years of experiencing his illness and also his poise and his grace in being able to handle it, were very growing years for me. I think very often as parents, we go into raising our children thinking that we are going to teach them how to be good people and we're going to be the ones molding them, and almost like our role in their life is more important than their role in our life as far as growing and knowing. And it's been my experience that the opposite is true, that especially now at 53 and being at this junction in my parenting years, I've definitely learned more from my children than I could have learned but from anyone else on the planet. And I think I've learned to pay attention to the things they say, not only my sons when they were ill, but also my daughters. And we share each other's wisdom, you know, and there are plenty of times in my life where I've thought, I gotta steer this thing this way or that and try to control a situation with them. And honestly, if I just let them lead, they find their own way and they do it very well. And they have their own inner strength that is surprising. And I've seen that kind of composure in sick kids many times, because after Justin died, I wanted to help other children, other families who had children with cancer. And so I started working for an organization out here that worked with kids with cancer. And I was their family outreach coordinator. And I was actually at an arcade night event out here where we had about, over 100 people there, with kids with cancer, and also kids who had, you know, their families who had experienced the loss of a child. And, you know, there were bumper boats and skee ball and all the fun things. And my job was to coordinate that event. And so I did. And that was the day that my husband called me and said that Jacob had leukemia. And so here I was at this event, and Jacob had had a cold for about a week, and I had gotten his blood drawn that day. And I just couldn't believe it. I'm at this event surrounded by other families with kids with cancer. I've already done this once, and I have to do it again. Like, it was so dramatic. I remember walking out the door. I just had to get out of all the noise, and I remember walking out the door onto this little patch of grass and just collapsing. I just sat down on this grass, and I looked up at the sky, and there was this the sky plane was going by skywriting, and it said 666 across the sky. And I was like, what is that? And coming from my Christian background, it was like, you know, this whole thing is evil. What is happening? And then I found out it was because of a movie. They were promoting a movie that day. But Jacob was diagnosed on 6606 at the age of six.
Wow.
Yeah. And so there were these little kind of nuances about life that I started to pay more attention to, and really spiritual moments, including when Justin, the night before Justin died, I had fallen asleep in the chair next to him. It was the wee hours of the morning in the ICU, and I had a dream that he was being resuscitated. And about 12 hours later, that dream in great detail was played out exactly as I had dreamt it, and Justin died. And so I had never had an experience like that before. It's still very vivid to me, in both in the dream experience and also in reality. And I had to make sense of all of these spiritual experiences that were happening surrounding these very devastating life events. And over time, and believe me, it's taken a lot of time, I've just come to a place of peace about having believing that we come into the world with a soul plan that I think from my Christian background gave me the roots and understanding of so many mindsets that I have. But after Justin's death, all of that blew up. I had to reconstruct so many things about what I believed, and because I came from such a conservative Christian realm, I was having spiritual experiences that were not acceptable to many people within the congregation I was in their belief systems. And so I really had to reformulate who I am, and go with kind of being more heart-centered and more spiritual. And I had so many spiritual experiences at the time that were considered, in the old teaching that I had known for so long, that were considered scary. And yet, exploring them myself, like having a dream and then having it happen, hearing a voice, at times it was more of an internal voice, but it was like hearing from an inner ear, seeing and just having knowings, solid knowings of that something was going to happen, or an awareness that it was more likely to happen, and then things happen. So, I think this is very common with people who have devastating life experiences. And I really believe it's because our heart is just cracked open. And in that opening is when we reconstruct and have a greater sensitivity to the energetic fields around us and the spiritual help that's around us. And so for me, that started with the dream. And then I had more dreams about Justin visiting me. And I also, during this time, was, especially in the early years after Justin's passing, I was very, very broken. And I remember laying in bed one night, this was just months after Justin died, when grief was very, very fresh. And I remember just praying to God to let me die. And I tend to be a very optimistic, upbeat person and happy person in general. And so this was the lowest I had ever felt in my life. And, you know, I had three young children still to raise, and my husband loved me and everything was good. And but the pain of our loss was so, so heavy that I just remember laying there, please, let's just let my breathing stop. I don't want to breathe anymore. I can't wake up to this reality again of Justin not being here and feel this pain. And I fell asleep, and I had this I dreamt that I was kind of like in a rabbit hole. I could see this tunnel and the big opening at the light, like just like what you would imagine, like Alice in Wonderland looking through the up the rabbit hole. And I remember Justin peeking over the edge of that opening and kind of waving me forward, like, come on, Mom, come on, you know, with his hand. And I could feel my heartbeat and my breathing slowing as I got closer and closer to the opening. And I was so happy. I thought, oh, I'm dying. This is great. I will see Justin and I don't have to do this anymore. And I got closer and closer, and I was almost there when Dave rolled over and snored very loudly and woke me up. Mm-hmm. And I remember waking up so mad because I was almost there and I almost got to see my son. And many months later, that dream really haunted me for a long time because I felt like Justin needed me. And I think that's also a very common experience when we have someone we love pass, is you feel like, you know, do they need me? I don't know. And why would they try to reach me on the other side? And you have so many thoughts that just nothing makes sense. And so a couple of years later, actually, I was led really to a medium, and I had been very closed-minded to using mediums. And this is a long story, so it's in the book, but how the progression of getting from being completely closed-minded to having spiritual support through a medium, to welcoming it. And it took a lot of soul searching. But I basically had a friend who, three different people who had gone to mediums on their own, for their own purposes, come and tell me that, that Justin was trying to reach me. And it sounds so strange for me to even, when I think of myself saying these things, because I would have, the old me would have been so close to even that idea. But when I lived it in the way I lived it, I couldn't say no. So I did go see a medium. And one of the things he told me was to ask Justin questions directly while we were there, and he could hear him through his angels. And all of that, again, was so foreign to me that I thought, this is too weird, but I'm going to do it anyway because I've been led here, so this is what I'm going to do. So I quietly, silently to myself, asked Justin about the dream. And this medium sat there silently, and I didn't say a word out loud. And he asked me, did you have a dream? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, what Justin is telling me is that he doesn't need you, but that he was so excited about being where he is that he wanted you to see it. And then when he said that to me, it totally made sense. Like, I got it. Because that's the kind of enthusiasm and happiness that was being projected in that dream to me, that Justin was excited and happy. And so it really helped give me some closure about where he was and that he was okay. And that he, and then he went on to describe all kinds of things that Justin was doing in the spirit realm or in this other space of in time where he was. And again, all of it sounds so crazy. And, but it was the most helpful thing in my grief process to create images that were positive, that were somewhat tangible, that were, they were relatable, rather than the old images that I had of life and death, which were, you know, life was lived here, and when you die, you're in a state of sleep or non-function, and that we all, they, you just wait in that state until everyone else is at, you know, where the rapture comes and all these different things, events happen, and then we all wake up. And so I liked this image better. It felt more true to me that we exist in a spiritual state elsewhere, that our energy doesn't die. And I like that that also aligns with the science that we know in quantum physics, and more and more science is proving that we do, that energy affects our world in a much bigger way than we have ever understood. And so I've learned to let my life lead me to what's next, and to embrace living a very joyful life, and accept what comes. And not as, and believe me, there've been plenty of challenges along the way still, but I don't look at challenges as punishment anymore. I think again, from my old roots, the idea of God being a punishing God was definitely ingrained in me from childhood. I remember, like if one of us, like I remember bumping my head and my mom would go, "Oh, God is punishing you." Or if you, you know, cut your finger or stubbed your toe, "Oh, God is punishing you," you know, and that feeling of needing to, confess your sins to the priest, and all those kinds of, practices made me look at God as though he was, and the belief that he's omnipotent and that he is a he, and all of those images really created a sense of, being a victim when Justin died, and being a victim when Jacob was diagnosed, and anytime there's been a crisis. And I was really taught, I learned to change my mind about that through children who were dying. One of them was a little girl named Elizabeth. She was 6 years old, and she was treated at the same time as Jacob, and we would see her at Children's Hospital LA. And when she had a very rare form of cancer, and when she was sent home on hospice care, I went and visited her, and I was friends with her mother. And my advice to her mother was to pay attention to what Elizabeth says, because at this point, and along the way, sick children say amazing things that go unnoticed, and they're just rich with wisdom. And so she did do that, and one day Emily called me, the mother, and she said, "I just wanted you to know what Elizabeth told me today." And Emily conveyed to me this story. She said, "I was holding Elizabeth in my arms, and I had told her, 'Elizabeth, I'm so grateful that God gave you to me, my only daughter.' And Elizabeth turned to her and said, 'Me too, Mommy. I had to wait such a long time for you.'" And Emily's awareness at that moment of being part of something bigger than this experience was profound. And she shared with me how she believed that Elizabeth agreed to be her her daughter. And there was this whole just awakening. And when I stood there in the backyard and Emily conveyed the story to me, it was like the sky opened up and I understood. And right from Elizabeth's world, "I had waited such a long time for you, Mommy," meant to me that Justin had agreed to be my son and I had agreed to be his mother well before we were ever in physical form. So after I talked to Emily, Elizabeth's mother, and heard from her, straight from her daughter's mouth, that when she said, "I waited such a long time for you, Mommy," was one of those moments in my life where it was like my mind opened up, the sky opened up. It was a time when I stopped seeing myself as a helpless victim of my own life, or a victim of a brutal God who just said, you know, this is the way it is, and you just have to suffer through life. For the first time, I realized that I was not a victim, but a participant. And that life, even with all of its tragedies, is not something that we have to suffer through, but rather experience and feel the emotion and learn what it is to be human at every level. And so I started looking at my life that way, where when, you know, other things would come along and I would think to myself, gosh, you know, like, if I, this is something I agreed to, whether it was a big move in the family or a job change or a person who came into my life who I really, you know, maybe rubbed me the wrong way. The idea that at some point before I came into physical form, I agreed to experience what I experienced, and was really pivotal for me. And because that mindset was already there before Jacob got sick, I was able to really handle his illness in a much more open-minded way. And as, even though it was very difficult, I don't want to sound like, oh yeah, I just accepted it all and, you know, great. It wasn't like that. It was, you know, I was angry, I was upset, I was fearful, but I had that internal knowing that I was courageous and strong and able to endure this experience, to learn from it, to benefit from it somehow, even though it was not something I would choose in my own human lifetime. I wouldn't have chosen to have my son die and have another one with cancer. You know, those are not things that we go, oh, you know, we don't have kids and think, oh, you know, what's this one going to teach me? Some tragic event will, you know, expand my awareness. Like, nobody thinks that way. At least I didn't. But it was helpful. It's a helpful mindset. And so most recently, I like exploring the teachings about soul plan. And a book that I read recently is called Your Soul's Plan by Robert Schwartz, and his second book, Your Soul's Gift. And I find it to be one of the most helpful books I've read, even though it is a stretch for me because it does involve mediums and psychics with different skill sets, and it also involves the belief system that we reincarnate and all kinds of things that are not within my normal range of thinking, especially with the background that I shared with you. Mm-hmm. But I love the message. I really do. I love the message behind the book, that we are more than we think we are. We are able and created really with the agreement to experience what we come to experience, and that we have, and everything has meaning, everything has purpose. There's not one tragedy, not one trial, and none of it is wasted. And and I like that. I like that imagery. And so sometimes, you know, if I'm going through something stressful, I'll pick up that book and I'll just read about it. Like, he has stories about people with all kinds of tragic life events. Alcoholism, child abuse, suicide, cancer, and it gives like a kind of like a backstory to their souls of what they agreed to and why. And I find that very helpful. So more and more, as I reach out to other people who are experiencing grief, I hear myself saying things like about Soul Plan that I, and whenever I'm in a situation where I think I've done the best I can in every aspect of my life and this negative thing pops up anyway, I just go, Soul Plan, because I know it's not my fault. You know, like so many times bad things happen and we think, you know, what did I do to bring this on? And, or what did I do as, and this is a form of punishment now or something like that. But, anyway, those mindsets, I've learned that as we go through life, it's really what's in our mind that, makes it either more or less difficult for us to manage. So, that's where I am now, and I have a grief center that I helped create with my friend Shaneen. It's called Just in Time Children's House, and it's brand new out here in Santa Clarita, and we're starting grief groups this coming fall. Just got an office of our own, and we've been at it for about a year now. We also host Death Cafe Santa Clarita, which is part of a global movement toward open communication around anything related to death. And they were started in London by a man named John Underwood and a friend of his. And Lizzie Miles is a social worker who brought Death Cafe to America. And then a friend of mine, Betsy Trapasso, who's a writer, brought Death Cafe to Los Angeles. And basically, it's a gathering of people who just want to get together and talk about anything related to their experiences, their thoughts around death. The premise is you just get together, have something to eat, and always end with cake. And I'm telling you, I love these death cafes because, you know, we talk about some very deep shared ideas, shared experiences, and then we always end up just laughing and having a really good time. There's a lot more laughter at a death cafe than there is crying. And we continue to host that, and I really think everyone should attend a death cafe at least once, just to have the experience of talking about the subject, because I think that's what makes it really difficult for us as Americans, especially to handle death and some of the tragedies that we experience, because we don't know how to talk about it, and we don't know how to address other people who are grieving. And when you sit around a table with people who are being very honest in a safe environment where there's no judgment and there's no agenda, which is the premise behind Death Cafe, it's very freeing and very helpful. The other thing I have going on is just raising Jacob. You know, he went back to school today. First day of high school, and it was really sweet because my husband just hugged him this morning and said, you know, this is a really special day. We've never had a son make it to high school. And Jacob got kind of a shy look on his face, like, you know, well, what's the big deal, you know, because to him his life is full and normal, and but to us it is a big deal, and life is a big deal, so... That's where we're at.
Be sure to tune in Monday for part two of our chat with Lisa.
You've been listening to the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. Visit our website at unmistakablecreative.com and get access to over 400 interviews in our archives.